From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Starting September 11th, we now have about 85 events organized in 46 states and about 7 international. It will kick off a fall of activities calling for peace, no invasion of Iraq.
Today, beating the drums for peace. We'll talk about alternative September 11th events with Global Exchange founder Medea Benjamin. But first, we'll look at U.S. officers saying U.S. aided in war despite use of gas, a New York Times piece that details a 1980s Reagan-Bush program that helped continued as Iraqis used chemical agents in the war against Iran. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Sunday New York Times reports on its front page that a covert Reagan administration program provided Iraq with critical battle planning assistance at a time when U.S. intelligence agencies knew Iraqi commanders were using chemical weapons in the Iran-Iraq war. This according to senior military officers with direct knowledge of the program. We'll have more on that story in a few minutes. Meanwhile, Norman Schwarzkopf and Wesley Clark have joined a growing number of senior military and political figures who are opposed to a unilateral invasion of Iraq. Schwarzkopf commanded Allied forces during the Gulf War. Clark led the NATO alliance during the bombing of Kosovo. Meanwhile, Russia has signed a new $40 billion economic cooperation agreement with Iraq, ignoring U.S. efforts to isolate the regime. And key U.S. ally Bahrain has refused to support a U.S. attack on Iraq. President Bush said Friday he's aware, quote, some very intelligent people are expressing opinions and that he's listening to the debate. But he added, quote, I'll be making up my mind based upon the latest intelligence and how best to protect our own country, plus our friends and allies. Meanwhile, the Washington Post has a front page piece today talking about how Democrats are concerned that if the issue in the midterm elections becomes the bombing of Iraq, that they could lose, with an emphasis on patriotism rather than the pocketbook. The London Independent is reporting British Prime Minister Tony Blair plans to use the margins of the Johannesburg Earth Summit to rally support for an attack on Iraq. But President Bush will not be there. The Bush administration announced over the weekend he will skip the Earth Summit and send Secretary of State General Colin Powell instead. Bush recently received a letter from a coalition of conservatives asking him to boycott the summit. Newsweek reported Sunday the UN has gathered enough evidence to justify a full-fledged criminal investigation into the details into the deaths in Afghanistan of close to 1,000 Taliban prisoners held by the U.S.-backed Northern Alliance, this according to a confidential UN memo. According to the memo, evidence has been uncovered which substantiates the rumors of mass graves as an area called Dasht-e-Layli. The captives allegedly died after being packed into sealed cargo containers en route from Kunduz to the Northern Alliance prison in Shebargan. The Washington Post is reporting, rather, Amnesty International called for an investigation based on a British documentary called Massacre at Mazar. The film described thousands of Taliban fighters being corralled into the containers after the Battle of Kunduz and claimed large numbers of prisoners died in the journey. The footage showed areas of compacted red sand, apparently caked with blood, traces of bones, including jaws and pieces of clothing. At the time, the jail in Shebargan was under U.S. control. The Boston-based group Physicians for Human Rights sent its own team to investigate the reported massacre and says it's repeatedly asked the U.S. and Afghan governments, as well as the United Nations, to secure the gravesite and launch a comprehensive criminal investigation. FBI forensic linguistics expert Don Foster believes the anthrax attacks were carried out by a senior scientist with CIA connections from within the biological defense community. He fears the CIA and the U.S. military are hampering the investigation by failing to deliver the documents he needs. Foster helped convict Unabomber Ted Kaczynski and unveiled Joe Klein as the author of the novel Primary Colors. The Israel and Palestinian governments have reached a tentative ceasefire agreement. Israeli forces will begin pulling out from the Gaza Strip and the West Bank town of Bethlehem in exchange for Palestinian efforts to reduce militant attacks. But Hamas and Islamic Jihad say they will not halt their attacks on Israel. Meanwhile, the Israeli Supreme Court granted a temporary injunction to Israeli and Palestinian human rights groups banning the Israeli army from using Palestinian civilians as human shields and or hostages. Last week, 19-year-old Ahmad Abu Mohsen was killed while being used as a human shield during the course of a military operation in the West Bank. Florida Governor Jeb Bush's appointee to head Florida's troubled child welfare agency is already under fire. A 1989 essay called The Christian Worldview of the Family bears Jerry Regier's name on the cover. In it, Regier supports spanking of children that may cause, quote, temporary and superficial bruises and welts. He also denounces abortion, parenting by gays, and says women should work outside the home only if the family is in a financial crisis and should consider such employment as bondage. Regier is denying he wrote the essay. The state of Ohio and a local prosecutor are appealing a judge's ruling that Vinton County cannot seek the death penalty for a man charged with killing a college student because of the huge expenses of defending the man in a capital trial. Vinton County Judge Jeffrey Simmons ruled last week that high defense costs and death penalty cases could compromise the defendant's due process rights. Experts say the ruling is the first of its kind. North Dakota Democratic Senator Byron Dorgan is asking the Justice Department why no company executives have yet been indicted. Dorgan is leading the investigation of Enron. Enron's CEO Ken Lay was one of President George Bush's biggest campaign donors. A spokesperson for the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, claims the Justice Department is working as fast as it can. And this news on the front page of the Washington Post today. The Department of Health and Human Services is reviewing the federal government's financial support of more than a dozen prominent AIDS service organizations whose members joined in a noisy demonstration against Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson at last month's International AIDS Conference in Barcelona. The Washington Post goes on to say HHS officials said they launched the reviews at the request of 12 members of Congress, who also said they were upset by the absence of religious themes at the meeting. While it remains unclear what the outcome of the audits might be, their existence has produced a level of suspicion and mistrust between AIDS activists and government officials not seen in years. مدينة الصلاة أصلي لأجلك يا بهية المساكن يا زهرة المدائن يا قدس يا قدس يا قدس يا مدينة الصلاة Jerusalem in my heart here on Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. For almost a year, the Bush administration has very vocally threatened to overthrow Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, labeling Iraq as part of an axis of evil, accusing it of posing a threat to international security. Administration officials, from the president himself to Vice President Dick Cheney, War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, point to Saddam's use of chemical weapons during the Iran-Iraq War as justification for a regime change. Last week, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice said the U.S. has no choice but to take action, citing again Saddam's use of chemical weapons. Yet many of the same administration officials now advocating bombing of Iraq supported Saddam Hussein 20 years ago, knowing he was using chemical weapons even then. Last week, we reported on Democracy Now! Producer Jeremy Scahill's story, The Saddam in Rumsfeld's Closet, in which he showed that War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld himself met with Saddam Hussein in Baghdad in 1983, opening the way for U.S. support, even as the State Department and the United Nations released reports clearly showing that Iraq was using chemical weapons. Now, the Sunday New York Times has run a front-page story called Officers Say U.S. Aided Iraq in War Despite Use of Gas. It details what the New York Times calls a covert U.S. program during the Reagan-Bush administration. The article says the program provided Iraq with critical battle planning assistance at a time when U.S. intelligence agencies knew that Iraqi commanders would employ chemical weapons in waging the decisive battles of the Iran-Iraq War. This according to senior military officers with direct knowledge of the program. The covert program was carried out at a time when President Reagan's top aides, including Secretary of State George Shultz, War Secretary Frank Carlucci, and General Colin Powell, then the National Security Advisor, were publicly condemning Iraq for its use of poison gas, especially after Iraq attacked Kurds in Halabja in March of 1988. Secretary of State Powell, through a spokesperson, told the New York Times the officer's description of the program was dead wrong, but declined to discuss it. His deputy, Richard Armitage, a senior defense official at the time, used an expletive relayed through a spokesperson to the New York Times to indicate his denial that the United States acquiesced in the use of chemical weapons. The Defense Intelligence Agency declined to comment in Patrick Tyler's piece in the Times, as did Lieutenant General Leonard Perutz, retired, who supervised the program as the head of the agency. Carlucci said, quote, "My understanding is that what was provided to Iraq was, quote, general order of battle information, not operational intelligence." He said, quote, "I certainly have no knowledge of U.S. participation in preparing battle and strike packages and doubt strongly that that occurred." Later, he added, "I did agree that Iraq should not lose the war, but I certainly had no foreknowledge of their use of chemical weapons." Though senior officials of the Reagan administration publicly condemned Iraq's employment of mustard gas, sarin, VX, and other poisonous agents, the U.S. military officers said President Reagan, Vice President George Bush, and senior national security aides never withdrew their support for the highly classified program in which more than 60 officers of the Defense Intelligence Agency were secretly providing detailed information on Iranian deployments, tactical planning for battles, plans for airstrikes, and bomb damage assessments for Iraq. We're joined on the telephone right now by Dilip Hero in London, writer and journalist. He's author of many books on the Middle East, including a trilogy on Iraq and Iran. His most recent book is Neighbors Not Friends, Iraq and Iran After the Gulf Wars. His forthcoming book, War Without End, The Rise of Islamist Terrorism and the Global Response, will come out in a few weeks. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dilip Hero. Yes, yes.
Thank you. Both books are published by Routledge in New York.
Well, we'll definitely look forward to getting a hold of this, especially the one that's coming out just in a few weeks, War Without End. If you could comment on the revelations that came out in the New York Times yesterday about the new details of the Reagan-Bush program that say that Iraqis used chemical agents.
I've got it in front of me here. I think just to take it from the top, as they say, when the war started in September 1980, then from early 1981, the U.S. AVAX planes stationed in Saudi Arabia provided intelligence to the Iraqis in almost every day as to the movements of the Iranian troops and so on. And so that particular program started as early as 1981. And in from 1983, Iraq started to use chemical weapons, and this happened quite frequently, especially when they were launching counter-offensives against the Iranians. And in fact, the UN Security Council had held its own investigations, and when they actually came to a resolution, that resolution combined the two things. They said, yes, Iraq is using chemical weapons. So at the same time, they pressed on the Iranians to have a ceasefire. Now, we must remember that there was no diplomatic relationship between Iraq and the U.S. until November 1984. That means, and those relations had been cut off after the 1967 war. But that did not stop the U.S. supplying information to Iraq against Iran. But after November 84, immediately after re-election of Ronald Reagan, the diplomatic relations were restored, and complete support for Iraq started to flow from late 84 onwards. And it is in that context we have to see what happened. You know, it's not only this question of the 60 officers who were actually involved in the battle plans of Iraq, etc., etc. There were two other things which happened, which of course are not mentioned here, which is that in summer of 1987, the U.S., the Pentagon Navy, practically opened a second front against the Iranians in the Persian Gulf. And when we come to 1988, when we are talking of these chemical attacks, et cetera, what happened was, starting early 1988, Iraq launched a series of offensives against the Iranians, including in the Fal Peninsula, which is to the end of the, which is along the Persian Gulf and next to, not very far from Kuwait. The Iraqis consistently and on a major scale used chemical weapons. It's a fact which has been, I did a book called The Longest War, the Iran-Iraq Military Conflict, and in which you will find all these details. So the overall situation is that on paper, the U.S. was neutral between these two bad regimes, Iran and Iraq. In reality, the U.S. was backing Iraq even when it did not have diplomatic relations with Baghdad. But after these relations were resumed, the support became extreme. Now, what's missing in this particular news story in the New York Times, they do not say that starting 1987, U.S. Air Force seconded its officers to work with the Iraqi Air Force Command to improve their targeting of the Iranian targets. And that started happening from 87, because from 87 onwards, there was almost 24-hour continuous bombing of the Iranian infrastructure, of bridges, factories, electrical power plants, and so on and so forth. So that is not mentioned here. And I think that is, if I could say, there's a missing link there.
Interestingly, in the New York Times piece, they also talk about the role of Saudi Arabia, the crucial role in pressing the Reagan administration to offer aid to Iraq out of concern that Iranian commanders were sending waves of young volunteers to overrun Iraqi forces. Prince Bandar bin Sultan, the Saudi ambassador to the United States then and now, met with President Saddam Hussein in Iraq, then told officials of the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA, that Iraq's military command was ready to accept U.S. aid. Then early in 1988, after the Iraqi army with U.S. planning assistance retook the Fal Peninsula in an attack that reopened Iraq's access to the Persian Gulf, a defense intelligence officer, now retired, was sent to tour the battlefield with Iraqi officers. He reported that Iraq had used chemical weapons to cinch his victory.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, in terms of the role of Saudi Arabia has been very crucial. You know, of course, we know what happened in 1990 when Iraq invaded Kuwait and occupied it, and mainly because Kuwaitis said to the Iraqi government, we lent you $12 to $14 billion, not in cash, but we sold oil for you, etc. Gave that money back. That was the pressure they applied so that they would give the money back and they would demarcate the disputed border between the two countries. But people forget that Saudi Arabia gave $25 billion to the Iraqi government. And, of course, they never asked the money back. You see, and in fact, Saudi Arabia had encouraged Saddam Hussein to attack Iran. And before the war started in September 1980, Saddam Hussein had actually shown his war plans to both the Kuwaiti Emir and the Saudi king. So, of course, the Saudis were deeply involved. But there's another factor, which is, of course, not here. Of course, in one news story, you can't have everything. A crucial role was played by King Hussein of Jordan. And when, because there were no diplomatic relations, so, of course, you know, there were American diplomats and the military men actually sitting in the embassy of another country, a European country, whose name escapes me now, and, of course, they're trying to help as much as they could. But every month there were meetings of the CIA station chief in Amman with the Iraqi intelligence people who would travel to Amman, and these meetings would take place in the presence of King Hussein of Jordan. And only after November 84, when diplomatic relations were resumed, there was much more open contacts there were. And, of course, the Saudi intervention, as mentioned in the New York Times story, makes complete sense because they were constantly, of course, you know, encouraging Saddam Hussein, not only in diplomatically, but with money. And you see, even the monies that I'm talking about, $25 billion from the Saudis and $12 to $14 billion from the Kuwaitis, we're talking of the government money. Individuals and organizations were encouraged to contribute voluntary donations to the war against Iran. And if you were in Kuwait, as I was in the 1980s, you would see the pictures of Saddam Hussein next to the picture of the Emir of Kuwait. So that whole thing was directed in which the U.S. played a very, very important and crucial role. And, you know, and of course, all is coming out. More interestingly, of course, there's a mention of the Iraqi chemical attack on a place called Halabja, which we all know, these two terrible pictures which came out from there. See, what happened in Halabja in March 1988, this attack with the chemical weapons on this city of 70,000 people, in which anywhere between, say, 4,000 to 5,000 people got killed and the 10,000 were injured. Now, when that happened, George Shultz, Secretary of State, said the evidence of the use of chemical weapons by Iraq is not, in quote, conclusive, unquote. And the same thing was
said by... Is not what? Say again. Is not inconclusive or conclusive?
No, not conclusive. Uh-huh. I mean, they have been used, but the evidence of the use of chemical weapons in Halabja is not, in quote, conclusive, unquote. And the same words were used by his counterpart, the British Foreign Secretary in London, Sir Geoffrey Howe, exactly the same words. And now what do we find? Condoleezza Rice. And, of course, before that, Mrs. Albright, all of them saying, oh, this man used chemical weapons against his own people. But when they were used at that time, in March 1988, the U.S. Closed its eyes. And you see, so much of that's being said now, I honestly have to say to myself, you know, it's as if I were a doctor in hospital, and I say to myself, oh, my God, I'm dealing with this patient who's suffering from acute amnesia.
Dilip Hira, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. We'll come back with this writer and journalist, author of a number of books on Iran and Iraq, Neighbors Not Friends, Iraq and Iran After the Gulf Wars, and his upcoming book is called War Without End. Be back with him in a minute. Stay with us.
Hayatına تبدا كلها بحيم حيم حرب كله ضارب ضرب صوت رصاص نازل ضرب ضرب كله خرب هرب لما يتصوب طفل صغير يرجع لاخر عصر الحمير تنصيت تقرير هذا كله تدبير هذا قدرنا هذا المصير بدي بصوتي احيي موتي مش رح تسمع له مره سكوتي العذاب القلب محضور ع اخوتنا اللي بالقبور يا ما زعوا الارض دم هذاك جني ولا دم بين الناس مشيت حزين مش عارفه حالي بانو مدين بحكيلكوا عسام كانه زيني مش شايفه الشارع الفلسطيني بيناديكوا بيناديني محتاج اللي بيقول لي انقذيني يلا نقوم نرمي هموم نحكي حكايه الحرب جاي هاي بس هي البدايه انقذوا الشعب العر معاي ان شاء الله سلام بيكون النهايه مضت ايام اجى العيد يوم فرح كان بعيد وهديه كانت شهيد والدمعه كان تشريد كل حياتنا بندافع على شعبنا شعب ليش اسا نستسلم احنا بعدنا بعدنا ان شاء الله يوقع وعد القتلى ان شاء الله يصير رماد على ارض الشهداء شهداء كل حياتنا بندافع على شعبنا شعب ليش اسا نستسلم احنا بعدنا بعدنا ان شاء الله يوقع وعد القتلى ان شاء الله يصير رماد على ارض الشهداء شهداء.
Music by Dom here on Democracy Now! The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking to Dilip Hero, writer and journalist, author of many books on the Middle East, a trilogy on Iran and Iraq. Yesterday, the New York Times had a front page piece. Officers say U.S. aided Iraq in war despite U.S. gas. This was 20 years ago during the first Reagan-Bush years. New details of 1980s program help continued as Iraqis use chemical agents. This follows the publication of the piece by Jeremy Scahill called The Saddam in Rumsfeld's Closet, where he showed first in 1983, it was actually Donald Rumsfeld at the time as an envoy for Reagan and Bush, went to Iraq, went back in 1984. And as the reports were coming out from the U.S. State Department, the United Nations, that Iraq was using chemical weapons in the war against Iran, he was pushing to open ties and recognize Saddam Hussein. In Jeremy Scahill's piece, he then writes, in 1988, Saddam's forces attacked Kurdish civilians with poisonous gas from Iraqi helicopters and planes. U.S. intelligence sources told the L.A. Times in 1991 they, quote, believe that the American-built helicopters were among those dropping the deadly bombs. In response to the gassing, sweeping sanctions were unanimously passed by the U.S. Senate that would have denied Iraq access to most U.S. technology. The measure was killed by the Reagan-Bush White House. Dilip Hero, why? And why did, why do you believe Saddam Hussein did do that gassing of the Kurds at Halabja?
I think what happened at Halabja was that, you see, Halabja is very near to the border with Iran. And that area is, this is where ethnic Kurds live. Now, both the Kurdish parties, whose leaders I'm sure you would remember were there in Washington, D.C. About 7 days ago, 10 days ago, both the Kurdish party, the Kurdistan Democratic Party, KDP, and the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, the PUK, both of them were actually allied with Iran and fighting against Saddam's government in Baghdad. And with their support, the Iranians had actually captured this town of Halabja, which is about 15 miles from the border. And the Iraqis thought that the Iranian troops were in the town, and when they actually dropped their chemical bombs on the place, they thought they were hitting the Iranian troops. But the Iranian troops had actually moved out of town. And so the end result was that it was actually the civilians, you know, the Kurdish or the Iraqi citizens, of course, you know, who got killed, you know, and the numbers, as I said earlier, vary between 4,000 to 5,000 killed, another 10,000 were injured. Now, of course, this, you know, particular terrible event was, you know, in any war exploited by Iran, and the world was shocked. At the same time, if you look at, you know, if you carry the story forward, because Iranians, you know, of course, you know, milk as much as they could, and rightly so, because, as you know, any war, it's not really you fight weapons, you fight psychological warfare, propaganda warfare. That's quite understandable. But because of what they did, their own people, that means Iranians themselves, started to think, oh, my God, Saddam is going to hit us with chemical weapons. And when this war of the cities started and Saddam's military had upgraded the Scud ground-to-ground missiles and given it about a range of 400 miles, with which they could hit Tehran, and they started doing that in 1988, after Halabja, when they started doing that, these missiles were hitting Tehran, and because of what people in Iran had seen, what happened in Halabja, and they say, oh my God, if these chemical weapons could hit us, we will be dead. And therefore, because of these attacks, half of the population of Tehran left the city. They went to live in other towns where they had relatives, etc., etc. And that has had a deeply demoralizing impact on the Iranians. And, you know, of course, as we know, the war then finished in August of 1988. So Halabja, in that sense, is very important in terms of psychological impact it had, in terms of the Iranian government, what it did. In fact, it themselves then tried to calm down the Halabja incident because it had a negative impact on their own people. But I think that, you know, when it comes to actually using these chemical weapons, it wasn't only then. See, the point is that starting in spring of 1988, the Iraqis had a series of offensives to retake the little area of theirs that the Iranians had captured from them in the long war. And in every case, in the Fal Peninsula, in the Majnoon Islands, in every case, they used chemical weapons on a very large scale. You know, use of chemical weapons became an ongoing part of their battle plans. And very interestingly, you know, since we're talking of UN inspections, etc., and it has been found through the UN inspectors' investigation that in the war, the Iraqis had used 110,000 munitions of chemical weapons. You know, because if you've got a chemical agent, which then you fill into either an artillery shell or you put it in a bomb, you drop the bomb or you fire artillery shell, and in that war, starting from 83 to August 88, the Iraqis had used such weapons, 110,000 of them. So that gives us an idea. But while all this was happening, not only that the U.S. did not condemn it, U.S. was a part of the plan. As I said earlier, in 1987, the U.S. opened a second front against the Iranians in the Gulf. And interestingly, this 1988 counter-offensives, if you know, you can actually see, I have given blow-by-blow account in my earlier book, The Longest War. See, while the Iraqis were using, you know, on the land, they were trying to retake their territory from the Iranians, the Americans were busy in the Gulf. They were hitting the Iranian Navy. They also hit the Iranian offshore islands with the oil fields, etc., etc. And so the two things, in fact, were coordinated.
Dilipiro, we only have a minute, but I wanted to ask you why you think these stories are coming out now. I mean, in Jeremy Scahill's piece, The Saddam and Rumsfeld's Closet, he's quoting articles from 10 years ago that are showing the U.S. knowledge of the use of chemical weapons. It's now 20 years later. Yes, it's the same people at the helm, the number two Bush regime. But why now are these pieces coming
out? Well, I think one can only speculate. I think it's quite possible that, you know, like those people who are directly involved, you know, the CIA and the DIA officials, you know, and they are retired now, so they can speak their mind. Of course, even though they don't always give their names, that could be one. And secondly, of course, you know, you find that, you know, people are constantly debating, what do we do next? And also, quite honestly, whenever I hear somebody like Ms. Rice or, you know, Mr. Fleischer, somebody, Saddam, or even George W. Bush, you know, who speaks such a very simple language, you know, that, you know, he gassed his own people. But all right, he gassed his own people, but you knew at that time, what did you do to stop him? You did not, you did not even condemn, you didn't even say he did it. Oh,
In fact, in the piece in the New York Times, it says, it quotes one veteran of the program saying, what difference does it make if people die as a result of bullet or phosgene? Finally, the visit of Iran to Afghanistan, the leader of Iran to Afghanistan, the significance of this?
So, leaders in Afghanistan?
Yeah, Iran meeting with Afghanistan.
Yes, I think you see, of course, the Iranians, you know, they understand. In fact, I did a piece in the Washington Post, you know, on the 28th of July, where I said, I have been to Iran, and those guys, they know that if Saddam is overthrown by force, you know, it's not, you know, if it is done, then they are next. You know, and because, you know, the evil acts. And the, very interestingly, let me put it this way. Now, you find that, you know, the axis of evil has three countries, Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. Would you believe that on the 7th of August in North Korea, they laid the foundation for a light water nuclear reactor, which would be partly funded by the U.S.? So Mr. Bush, in his triangle of Iran, Iraq, and North Korea, has totally forgotten about North Korea, and he's concentrating on Iran and Iraq. You may wonder why. Because I tell you why. Because you have to always look at the U.S. policy in the Middle East through the eyes of the Israeli interest. Because if you are Israeli, on your radar screen, North Korea doesn't come in. You know, I mean, it's so far away. What has North Korea got to do with Israel? But they definitely consider Iraq and Iran as a, you know, deadly enemy. And because the Bush policy is driven from, you know, from the Israeli government and the pro-Israeli lobby, and that's why we are focused on Iraq, and of course next is Iran, and surely after Iran will be Syria, and so on. So I think that this is something, and all that's happening in the name of what you call regime change. There's one word for it, and that word was in fact used by the International Herald Tribune executive editor David Ignatius on his article, op-ed piece on 6th of July. This is, he called, these are the policies of neo-imperialists. These are not my words, and this is his word. Okay, you know, it is in the Herald Tribune on the 6th, 7th of July of this year, and he has called people like Rumsfeld, people like Wolfowitz, and Robert Kagan as neo-imperialists. So I think that's basically what we're talking about. In terms of talking of regime change, is a label put on essentially the kind of a story. I mean, I come from India. I know about British imperialism. No, this is the new imperialism. So,
De La Pira, I want to thank you for being with us, writer and journalist. His new book coming out is War Without End, The Rise of Islamist Terrorism and the Global Response, as well the trilogy that ends, Neighbors Not Friends, Iraq and Iran After the Gulf Wars. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As the administration beats the drums of war for a possible bombing of they're already bombing Afghanistan, but bombing of Iraq, an intensification of that bombing, because let's not forget that they are bombing Iraq on a regular basis. There's a front page piece in the Washington Post about how Democrats worry about Iraq as an issue. Dan Balls writes, Iraq is emerging as the wild card issue of the 2002 election, with Democrats nervously watching a growing debate over whether the United States should launch a war to oust President Saddam Hussein, fearful it could shift attention away from the economic issues that now dominate their agenda. The idea that Bush would be appealing to patriotism over pocketbook. September 11th is coming up, and there are all sorts of events that are planned. Human rights groups have also begun forming a coalition called United for Peace to promote justice and healing on the first anniversary of the terrorist attacks in the United States. Events including candlelight vigils, interfaith ceremonies are planned for major cities to send the message that our grief is not a cry for war. Medea Benjamin joins us now, co-founder of Global Exchange. Welcome.
Thank you, Amy.
Well, can you tell us about these plans?
Well, we at Global Exchange helped to form a new coalition called United for Peace and started talking to groups around the country and saying, what are you going to do on September 11th or around September 11th? And found that people really felt a need to be together in a place on September 11th with people that were like-minded, and more importantly, to send a message to the media, to the Bush administration, and around the world that the way we feel that we should commemorate the lives of those who died on September 11th is saying, no more innocent victims, no more war. And we put out this call, and Amy, the response has been absolutely overwhelming. In fact, we had to create this new website just to list all the events that are happening. I can't keep up with that. I think the last I looked, there were 85 events happening, and we had 46 states. We are determined to get every single state. And when you look at the kind of creativity, it's events that really fit the needs of the local community. So a group in New York is going to do an overnight vigil on the 10th into the 11th in Washington Square Park that includes family members who lost people on September 11th, includes Afghan Americans who lost people during the U.S. military campaign, while a group in New Orleans says, hey, the way we commemorate the lives of those who die, we mourn for the first year and then we party, so we're doing a party for peace. So it will be very, you know, specific to local communities, but a time for local communities to really build coalitions saying no to Bush's response to the tragic events of September 11th.
Medea Benjamin of Global Exchange will come back with her in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
My country, 'tis of thee, all of this misery. How can I call myself yours? How many brave and free tonight will homeless be? How can I call myself yours? And I am an American. I was born here on this land, but I will never understand why we'd build a bomb instead of feed a man. My country, I weep for thee. My country, I weep for thee. My country, 'tis of thee, all of this misery. How can I call myself yours?
My Country by Laurie B. here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. A new federal registry to boost surveillance of visitors to the United States who spark elevated national security concerns will be launched on September 11th. The entry-exit registration system responds to a congressional mandate to track, quote, virtually all of the 35 million foreign nationals who visit the United States annually before 2005. The program, which will start at select ports of entry for travel by land, air, and sea for a 20-day trial period before full implementation on October 1st, requires the fingerprinting of a small percentage of foreign visitors. Nationals of Iran, Iraq, Libya, Sudan, and Syria, countries listed on the U.S. State Department's list of state sponsors of terrorism, will be fingerprinted, as will, quote, non-immigrant aliens whom the State Department determines to present an elevated national security risk. This, according to the Justice Department. Those prints will then be matched against databases of known criminals and known terrorists, selected according to, quote, intelligence criteria reflecting patterns of terrorist organizations' activities. The registry will also require individuals check in periodically with authorities, similar to programs already in place across Europe. This, again, a plan that is being put forward by Attorney General John Ashcroft. Advocates for Arab and Muslim Americans have complained the new rules are biased. When the program was announced in June, the Council on American Islamic Relations said it would likely create a false sense of security and end up further damaging America's image and reputation around the world. So that is going to be implemented for September 11th. Medea Benjamin of Global Exchange, you're talking about different kind of programs around the country for September 11th. For people who are thinking about organizing now, but not sure in this climate what this could mean. Would this mean that they'll be targeted? Are they willing to open themselves up to any kind of investigation? Or what is your response to that?
My response is we got to get out there and organize and stop all of this, the destruction of our civil liberties here at home and the possible leading us down the path to World War III. So we are just encouraging people to get out in new kind of ways and organize new kind of coalitions. September 11th is a great time to start doing that and to be, like there's a group in Providence, Rhode Island, taking out a full-page ad in their newspaper saying, remember them through peace. A group in Minnesota that's saying, take the day's wages and donate it to your favorite peace group. Another group that's saying, take the day and help raise funds for Afghan victims. There are so many different ways that people can use September 11th to express their desires for peace. And September 11th has to be seen as one date of the beginning, I think, of a fall of activities across this country where we step up our protests against the Bush administration in a qualitatively and quantitatively new way. We really have to build a peace movement that is on the level of the kind of crisis that we're facing. And through September 11th organizing, we've managed now to get in touch with peace groups all around the country, from Boise, Idaho, to New Orleans, to Providence, to in Texas alone, I think we have 10 groups that are organizing. This is the kind of structure we need to then take it to the next level and say, okay, everybody, on October 5th and 6th, let's get out there again, and let's focus on civil liberties, let's focus on Iraq. So I think we have very little time, and we've got to be, I think all of the fear that many of us are facing about how the government is reacting is obviously to keep us from organizing. And we have to overcome that fear and remember our friends around the world who are facing much, much, much more dangerous conditions than we are, and get out there and show the rest of the world that there is an American peace movement, and that in addition to the Arabs on the street who were saying no to a U.S. invasion of Iraq, in addition to the hundreds of thousands of people that come out in Europe, that we in the United States, too, can show that we have a strong, growing, and very militant peace movement.
Global Exchange was raising money for Afghan victims of the bombing of Afghanistan. We had in the studio Rita Lassar, who lost her brother Abe Zalmanowicz on the 27th floor of the World Trade Center, and Masuda Sultan, who lost 19 members of her family in a U.S. bombing of a farmhouse in Afghanistan where her family was taking refuge. She's an Afghan-American. How far have your your efforts turned up in terms of support, and where does Congress stand on that issue, reparations for the people of Afghanistan?
Well, we continue to advocate very hard for a victims fund, and in fact, we are now bringing over one of the women in Afghanistan who lost her husband and children due to a military bomb that went astray, and she'll be coming here in September. We think that we have succeeded in getting some money put aside for rebuilding houses that were destroyed during the bombing campaign, and we think we might be successful in getting some money into something called the Leahy War Victims Fund that will help people with things like prosthetic legs. We haven't been successful in getting individual assistance to families. But we hope that we will be successful in getting at least the housing and the medical assistance.
If people want to get information on the alternative events for September 11th, where can they go on the web, see what different people are doing, figure out what they want to do?
It's a new exciting website called unitedforpeace.org. And I want to make a plea to everybody listening, Amy, to think right now, where are you going to be on September 11th? What are you going to be doing that will show your community, the Bush administration, the U.S. media, and the international community that there is this growing peace movement? So let's take this one seriously. Let's take it all personally and make sure if there's something going on in your community that you get involved and make it bigger and better. If there's not something going on, you still have time to do something.
Medea Benjamin of Global Exchange, thanks for being with us. And in our last segment of the program today, this week's Newsweek is reporting that the United Nations has gathered enough evidence to justify a full-fledged criminal investigation into the deaths in Afghanistan of close to 1,000 Taliban prisoners held by U.S.-backed Northern Alliance. This according to a confidential U.N. memo. According to the memo, evidence has been uncovered, which substantiates the rumors of mass graves as an area called Dasht il Laili. The captives allegedly died after being packed into sealed cargo containers en route from Kunduz to the Northern Alliance prison at Shebargan. Amnesty International called for an investigation based on a British documentary called Massacre at Mazar. The film described thousands of Taliban fighters being corralled into the containers after the Battle of Kunduz and claimed large numbers of prisoners died in the journey. The footage showed areas of compacted red sand, apparently caked with blood, traces of bones, including jaws and pieces of clothing, the time the jail in Shebregan was under U.S. control. Well, the Boston-based group Physicians for Human Rights sent its own team to investigate the reported massacre and says it has repeatedly asked the U.S. and Afghan governments, as well as the United Nations, to secure the gravesite and launch a comprehensive criminal investigation. We're joined right now by Leonard Rubinstein, who is Executive Director of Physicians for Human Rights. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about this latest confidential UN memo about the perhaps 1,000 Taliban prisoners who may be in mass graves in the area known as Dasht-e-Laili?
Well, the memorandum is really not that much of a surprise to us. Back in January, our investigators discovered the grave, and in February, we sent our forensic director to examine it. One couldn't exhume it because there was no security and no authorization, but there was certainly enough information from those preliminary assessments to warrant an investigation. So since March, we have been asking the United Nations, the Afghan government, and of course the United States, which is the only entity that has the capacity to provide the security for an investigation, to investigate this site.
Can you talk about what you believe happened?
Well, we don't have the information about what happened. As the Newsweek story reports, witnesses said that prisoners who surrendered at the battles of Mazar-e-Sharif and Kunduz were transported in sealed containers to the Shebregan prison, and those containers led to the death by asphyxiation of the people in them. Those reports are based on witness accounts, and although we heard some of those accounts, we are not making any inferences yet. Our work is to get the truth from the people who are in the grave. That will tell the true story of what happened, how many were killed, the circumstances of their death, and we'll also learn something about who is responsible.
Can you talk about the response of the U.S. government?
Unfortunately, most of the response has been no response. We've had meetings with members of the Pentagon staff and in the State Department. The Pentagon has told us they would not do an investigation. They would not provide security. The State Department really has not answered us at all. There has been really quite a deafening silence about these events. And that's been very distressing, especially given the articulated commitment of the U.S. government to investigate and prosecute war crimes.
What about the United Nations response? This is a confidential memo that we just quoted.
The memo was based on an investigation by the U.N. High Commissioner for Human Rights, which did send a team in April and May, and our forensic director was part of that team. So the High Commissioner for Human Rights has taken the initiative, but since April and May, the United Nations hasn't done anything, and we have been pressing the UN as well to move forward with this investigation.
The Newsweek report includes multiple eyewitness accounts alleging that Northern Alliance forces under the command of General Abdul Rashid Dostum may have killed through suffocation in containers as many as 2,000 to 3,000 Taliban and foreign prisoners after their surrender at Kunduz in November of last year. Can you talk about who General Abdul Rashid Dostum is in relation to the United States?
Well, General Dostum is the warlord who controls most of the area around Mazar-e-Sharif, and it was his troops that were allied with the United States in the battles against the Taliban in the fall of 2001, and he continues to control that region. So he has been closely allied with the United States, although we are not saying that the U.S. troops had any knowledge engagement in the actions of General Dostum. We simply don't know.
And what would it mean to secure the grave site?
Well, whenever there are grave sites, there are always people who are interested in destroying the evidence. This happened in Bosnia. It's happened all over the world. And the only way to prevent tampering or destruction of the grave sites is to guard them. And security for a grave site means guarding them so that no one tampers with them. It also means assuring that the sites are clear of landmines so they can be properly investigated without danger. That's what security for a gravesite means, and it has to be constant, and it has to be effective.
And the response of Hamid Karzai, you've sent a letter to him, the U.S.-backed Afghan president.
We did send a letter to President Karzai back in March. As you know, the Bonn Agreement back in December, which set the path for the future of Afghanistan, established that there should be a human rights component to the government and a human rights commission in Afghanistan. And we think that President Karzai has a role in this investigation as a matter of bringing his own country together and making sure that cycles of retaliation and reprisal, which have been quite destructive, especially in the north, would end. We recognize, though, that he doesn't have the military ability to provide the security, nor the scientific and personnel resources to do the investigation. We think he should be engaged in the process, but we can't say that he can take full responsibility for doing it.
Finally, I wanted to ask you, Leonard Rubinstein, Executive Director of Physicians for Human Rights, said we're having this conversation at the same time the U.S. is continuing to try to subvert the effectiveness of the newly established International Criminal Court. What about U.S. culpability here? I mean, if you're talking about what looks like mass graves. The Newsweek piece begins with trudging over the moonscape of Dasht-e-Leili, a desolate expanse of low-rolling hills in northern Afghanistan. Bill Haglund spotted clues half buried in the gray-beige sand, strings of prayer beads, a woolen skull cap, a few shoes. Those remnants, along with track marks and blade scrapes left by a bulldozer, suggested that Haglund had found what he was looking for. Then he came across a human tibia, three sets of pelvic bones and some ribs. If, in fact, what we're looking at is evidence of war crimes, what about an international criminal court and the U.S. trying to say that no soldiers, no U.S. officials should be brought before such a court?
Well, first of all, as you know, and your listeners know probably, these events took place before the effective date of the new international criminal court, so they couldn't be brought there. We think a special tribunal will be necessary. We also, as I said before, have no evidence that the United States has any criminal culpability here. On the other hand, I think what this does show is that blanket immunity for the United States is a very bad idea, that there may be circumstances where there is a responsibility. And, of course, if there is a responsibility, the first thing the United States should do is investigate and prosecute through its own mechanisms, as the court statute provides. But it does show that that these efforts to secure immunity are misguided at best and can be undermining of the court at worst.
If people want to find out more about what's happening in Afghanistan now and the Physicians for Human Rights investigation, where can they go on the web?
Our website is phrusa.org, and we'll keep it current so people can find out how this effort is progressing.
Leonard Rubinstein, thanks for joining us, and that does it for the show. Tomorrow on Democracy Now! We'll go to the reparations rally that occurred. happened this weekend on Saturday in Washington, D.C. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Jeremy Scahill, Dexter X, with help from Scott Harris. Jolie Rickman is filling in as our music maestro. Mike DiFilippo is filling in as our engineer, as Anthony Sloan continues to recuperate. We all wish him the very best. You can email us or him at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Our website is www.democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.